I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Welcome to Fronteras, a show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Immigration attorneys and DACA recipients are lashing back at Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. Paxton filed a lawsuit in Brownsville this week to kill the Obama-era Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Texas Public Radio's Ryan Poppy reports.
Paxton threatened to sue the Trump administration if it did not end the DACA program. He says the program was not created by Congress and therefore should be declared unconstitutional. Lance Curtwright, a San Antonio immigration attorney, says it's easy to see why DACA recipients and their families feel under attack.
I think it will further solidify the notion that there's a major political movement against DACA recipients and their families. It all just kind of accumulates into this feeling that they're not wanted, that they're in fact being targeted.
And Curtwright believes the lawsuit will also engender more fear and anxiety among DACA recipients. The federal DACA program was created to provide work authorization and protection against deportation for someone who was brought into the U.S. illegally. A federal court in Washington, D.C. blocked President Trump's efforts to end DACA if Congress could not come up with a more permanent program of its own. But immigration attorneys say many DACA recipients fear that they will be separated from their families if the federal program ends. Paxton also filed a preliminary injunction to stop the federal government from issuing or renewing any DACA application while the lawsuit remains pending. Ryan Poppy, Texas Public Radio News.
Vice President Mike Pence visited the California-Mexico border Monday, some 100 miles east of San Diego. Pence was there to reinforce the Trump administration's strict immigration stance. He emphasized that federal agents will no longer catch and release individuals suspected of violating immigration laws. Steve Walsh reports for KPBS in San Diego.
Before a group of roughly 300 Border Patrol agents, Pence addressed the migrant caravan amassing across from San Diego over the weekend.
This caravan, like those who have gone before, is also rightly understood as a deliberate attempt to undermine the laws of this country and the sovereignty of the United States.
He called the migrants victims of activists and agenda-driven media. Pence's visit highlights a section of the wall under construction in Calexico.
We are protecting the American people by securing our southern border. And we are building a wall.
So here it is, the brand new wall. It's 30 feet high as compared to 18 feet high on the old legacy wall. It's going to go for about 2.25 miles and cost about $18 million.
The president has pointed to this construction as evidence that his administration is making good on his pledge to build a new wall. In fact, this section replaces a section of wall that's 20 years old and had been in the planning stages for years. Pence also highlighted the National Guard. He says 250 California guardsmen are on their way to the border. They join nearly 1,000 guardsmen from other states already amassing along the U.S. side of the Mexican border. They are supposed to free up Border Patrol agents.
Reporting from Calexico, right next to the Mexican border, Steve Walsh, KPBS News.
Texas used to resettle more refugees than most states in the country, but the state is experiencing a record low in the number of people being resettled. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports.
Ahmed Asadi moved to Austin from Afghanistan this past November. He brought his family with him, including his wife and daughters.
I have two daughters. One is 5 years old. Her name is Asia. And other is 3 years old. Her name is Safia.
Asadi worked for a company back in Afghanistan that contracted with the U.S. government and NATO forces. He said that job provided him with a good living.
I had good life in my country. I had my own house, everything. I had a good salary.
But a job helping Americans and NATO forces fight a war in his country came with some serious risks.
It's clear for everyone the security situation is not good in my country, especially for those people who work with the U.S. government or NATO forces. So it was not good. It was not good for me to stay in my country. That's why I plan to leave. To have a better life for my kids and my, especially for my wife also.
So Asadi applied for a special visa offered to folks who work with the U.S. government. It's a program within the larger U.S. refugee resettlement program. He says the whole process took about 2 years, which he says is actually pretty speedy.
Even some people are waiting for 5 years, still they didn't get their visas. So that's why it took 2 years. But for me, it was normal.
Asadi is in a rare position right now. He's one of the very few refugees who have been resettled in Texas and in the U.S. in general in the past several months. Erica Schmidt-Pertnoy is the area director for Refugee Services of Texas in Austin. She says she's seeing way fewer people being resettled here than ever before.
Being with the organization for over 6 years at this point, there's a stark contrast to what the refugee resettlement program looks like now compared to in past years.
Compared to this time last year, Schmidt-Pertnoy says Texas has seen a 79% decrease in the number of refugees resettled here. In Austin, there's been a 57% drop. Schmidt-Pertnoy says the reason this is happening is because the Trump administration has issued new policies aimed at stopping refugees from coming to the U.S. That includes the travel bans that have been in and out of court.
And all of that has resulted in a slow trickle of the program at this point, and a trickle of refugees who have no other opportunity for resettlement in any other part of the world.
Historically, Texas has resettled a big share of the country's refugee population. Schmidt-Pertnoy says that's because the state has had a strong economy. That means refugees can find work here, which is a win-win. But she says things are different now.
And to not have refugees coming in is hard to watch.
Especially for people who do the work of resettling refugees.
The past year has just been really difficult.
That's Simone Tama Flowers. She's the executive director of Interfaith Action of Central Texas. Her group provides services like English classes to refugees here in Austin.
We know that there is a world refugee crisis happening. This is the worst refugee crisis since World War II. And yet we are seeing such a harsh decline in the numbers of refugees that are new arrivals.
And this slow trickle of refugees isn't just a moral and humanitarian failing, Flowers says. It's also putting the entire refugee resettlement program at risk, programs that are serving people who are already here. She says these groups are going through some tough financial times right now.
So the funding that comes is tied to a lot of new arrivals. So when there's not many new arrivals, that money is drying up. It's not much.
Flower says groups are looking at having to raise private donations or lay people off.
So that's a huge concern, to be able to keep doors open.
Flower says a lot of people who are coming in are people like Ahmed Asadi, people with special visas from Afghanistan. But she says the U.S. is hardly letting in people from countries like Syria, where people are facing imminent death.
People are dying. And when we look back on history, we're going to ask ourselves, why did we not do anything? Were we afraid? I mean, what are we afraid of? Why are we not supporting these fellow human beings?
Back in Austin, in a temporary home provided to Ahmed Asadi and his family, Asadi says he knows he's lucky to be here. He says he's looking forward to making a new life in Austin.
Everyone's saying the U.S. is a country of opportunities. So yeah, I hope in the future I can make something for my family.
Because Texas has such a large existing refugee population, a lot of the people trying to come to Texas are hoping to reunite with family. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
Still to come on Fronteras, Juan Seguin is not as well known as other Alamo defenders, but his role was still significant as he was one of the few native Tejanos fighting for independence.
Everybody else was an immigrant, either from other states or other countries.
That's coming up after this break. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Welcome back to Fronteras. If you're driving west on Highway 90 into Marfa, you'll spot a new landmark from the road, a community mural in vivid color. It's been in the works now for about a year. And as Marfa Public Radio's Sally Beauvais reports, the mural tells the lesser-known stories of the city's history.
It's a sunny, breezy day in Marfa, and El Paso artist Jesus Simi Alvarado and his team are painting the base for the community mural they're installing. The wind slowly rocks the lift one of Alvarado's helpers is standing on. 18-wheelers and trucks pass by, filing in and out of the Stripes gas station parking lot where Alvarado and his crew are working. The mural, he says, is based on memories and photographs from people in Marfa.
Seeing them makes you think of your cousin, or, you know, people that you know, people that you grew up with. So that's why I say, like, a lot of these stories are really similar to our stories or where we came from, you know, and most of our people's stories kind of end up linking together somehow.
Looking at the mural, you'll see the stories. There's Blackwell, Marfa's segregated school for Hispanic students until 1965. There's the Presidio County Courthouse, images of children playing on a steel merry-go-round, a glider floating above the region's vast desert landscape, and standing prominently in the corner are brothers Avalardo and Adalberto Franco.
They were high school students.
Gretel Inc. is with the Blackwell School Alliance, the group that commissioned the mural. The Franco brothers, she says, were star players on a Marfa basketball team in 1947 that went on to a state championship game.
And it's still a big story. I don't know that we've ever had another sports team that went on to state finals. They did lose by 2 points, but I think it's worth remembering their names.
And for Alvarado, that's the point. He wants to preserve this history for Marfa's next generation.
And tell them about the stories about their tíos and abuelitos and how important those people are to our communities.
At the mural's public unveiling, mariachis, complete in their traditional trajes, welcomed locals and visitors. Cidia Acosta was there. She grew up in the era of segregation. And when she sees the Blackwell School prominently featured, she's reminded of how far the community has come, but also how far it has to go.
We have one thing that's a cemetery. There's still a fence there between the whites and the Hispanics.
Jesse Silva attended Blackwell in the 1950s. She says the mural offers people the opportunity to understand the region.
There's a lot of history in Marfa, and a lot of people who come into Marfa have checked Marfa out. They have read something about Marfa, so a little bit acquainted.
But this mural, she says, lets people come face to face with that history, not just read about it. Both Acosta and Silva say the mural is a big moment for Marfa's Hispanic community. Marfa Mayor Anne Marie Nafziger says the mural is also important for another reason.
It's a counterpoint, if you will, to the kind of art that usually gets a lot of attention in this town.
Marfa, she says, has become known as a hub for minimalist art. But this mural isn't that. She says this art is unlike anything else in Marfa.
We don't have to go to a museum or a gallery to see it. Instead, we'll happen upon it as we go about our daily business.
And by seeing the work daily, mural artist Simi Alvarado says people will keep thinking about its message, history. In Marfa, I'm Sally Beauvais.
Juan Seguin is a key figure of the Texas Revolution, but he isn't often mentioned in the same breath as other heroic figures such as Sam Houston, Stephen F. Austin, William Travis, or Davy Crockett. Seguin was born in San Antonio in 1806. Prior to the battles at the Alamo and San Jacinto, Seguin was an elected official serving as an alcalde, a mayoral figure, in 1833. He began a military career a couple of years later, serving as a scout and providing supplies for Stephen F. Austin's Revolutionary Army. In 1836, Seguin was at the Alamo when Santa Anna's siege began, but he was sent away as a courier a few days before the Alamo fell in March 1836. Santa Anna's army was defeated in only 18 minutes at the Battle of San Jacinto the following month. Seguin's unit was the only unit of Tejanos, Mexican Texans, to fight at San Jacinto. Seguin accepted the Mexican government's surrender of San Antonio and served as the city's military commander. Seguin was also the only Tejano to serve in the Texas Senate. Bill Neely is the author of the Seguin biography, A Tejano Knight, The Quest of Don Juan Seguin. Neely says despite the prestige earned after the revolution, Juan Seguin still felt like a foreigner in his native land.
The people who streamed into Texas after San Jacinto were anti-Mexican because of the brutality of Santa Anna in killing all of the Alamo defenders and also the prisoners in Goliad who had surrendered but were shot down. So Juan Seguin suffered, as did many Mexicans in the interior of Mexico, from the actions of Santa Anna. So the late coming Anglos to Texas did not want to have a Mexican mayor. They resented his role as a colonel in the Texas Army. They began to spread rumors that he was a traitor, Well, meanwhile, the Mexican officers were very angry at Juan Seguin because he had been there to see them defeated. He had helped defeat them. And so General Vasquez came to San Antonio in spring of 1842, pulled a so-called letter out of his pocket that was supposedly from Juan Seguin. So he pulls out the letter, and there are only mainly Anglos left in San Antonio. And he says, this is from Juan Seguin, and he tells me that he is going to help Mexico retake Texas. Juan Seguin's enemies in San Antonio had heard what they wanted to hear. So they eventually drove him out of town and even away from his ranch. So Seguin fled to Mexico, where he was promptly arrested and given a choice of fighting in the Mexican army against the Texans or going to prison. So he decided to fight. It was a terrible choice, horrible choice to have to make.
But he did eventually make his way back to Texas.
He made his way back to Texas after the U.S.-Mexican War. And his father, Erasmo, had a 22,000-acre ranch that was formerly the ranch lands of the Alamo Mission. And so there was enough land there for his son Juan and the family to reestablish themselves, having been elected Justice of the Peace twice and helping to establish the Democratic Party in Texas with Anglo Samuel Maverick. He wrote his memoirs in 1858, explaining what all had happened and the horrible choice he had to make, whether to go to prison or fight under the Mexican flag. And he had a really good life after he came back to San Antonio.
So in your book, A Tejano Knight, you have done a lot of extensive research to discover more about Juan Seguin. You've turned that book into a screenplay, and that has got to be a much different prospect than writing a book, because you have to go into more generalities when it comes to a screenplay. You can't really get into too much details. You can't get into the thoughts of a character. So when you are writing a screenplay for A Tejano Knight, what approach do you take with the existing material?
Well, I try to see the movie unfolding in front of me, and I just try to set the setting and write the words for the characters. And I try to expose their character through their words and actions. Of course, there has to be a conflict. And there are inner conflicts and exterior conflicts. It shows Juan Seguin's inner conflict when he is presented this terrible choice between going to prison or fighting against his former comrades in Texas. And then the outer conflict is Austin's desire to establish a slaveocracy in Texas.
And I thought that was a really interesting thing about your screenplay, was that you portray Stephen Austin as being very pro-slave, really trying hard to get slaves to come in and help build these colonies. And he was also, despite his friendship with Juan Seguin, who I understand adored Stephen Austin really did not like Mexicans.
No, he did not. And he hated Catholicism.
One very famous fact about Juan Seguin is that he was an Alamo defender, but he did not die because he was sent out before the Mexican army invaded and attacked the Alamo. So that obviously is going to be a big portion of your screenplay. How do you keep that part of the story from being more about the other Alamo defenders than about Juan Seguin?
They're talked about. Rather than showing the battle, we refer to the battle. And when he did leave after the third day to go to Gonzales for reinforcements, he did succeed. 31 brave men from Gonzales went into the Alamo, where they were all killed. And so actually Juan wants to go back to the Alamo, and General Houston will not let him. And General Houston says, I need you to protect the women and children as we leave this area to go into the East Texas to get away from the Mexican army. So that was Juan's job, and he did follow orders, even though he wanted to go back. Seven of his men that followed him into the Alamo were killed. They were native Texans. They were the only Texans in the Alamo. Everybody else was an immigrant, either from other states or other countries.
So you had mentioned before the interview that when you were adapting your book into a screenplay, that it was very freeing. What was freeing about that process for you?
No end notes, no bibliography. I could just be creative. I could be an artist. I am a scholar in the book. I'm an artist with a screenplay.
So I'm sure that you're thinking casting when you're writing out the screenplay. Do you maybe have a dream cast of who you'd like to play
Antonio
these characters?
Antonio Banderas as once again. Dennis Quaid played Sam Houston once upon a time. He's one of my favorite actors. I would like to see that again.
Do you keep that in mind when you're writing? Do you think these are lines I'd really like Antonio Banderas to say? Or
well, no, not while I'm writing, because I'm actually seeing the real person that I'm writing about and not the actor.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you very much.
Bill Neely is an author based out of Oklahoma. His latest book is A Tejano Night, The Quest of Don Juan Seguin. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Norma Martinez and Jerry Quijano produced the broadcast. Our executive producers are Steve Short and Fernando Ortiz. Our digital editor is Vince Kong. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.